Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1085. Interview with Tom O'Neill about chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the secret history of the 60s. This is being recorded on August 27th of the year 2019. It is my pleasure and my privilege to bring to our airwaves Tom O'Neill, the author of the aforementioned Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. Tom, welcome to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You spent many years, decades really, roughly 20 years, pursuing the story of Charles Manson and his family, unquote, and the killings that they performed. Originally, you began doing this in 1999, which was the 30th anniversary of the killings themselves, which took place on August 8th and 9th of 1969. We have just passed the 50th anniversary of SANE, and your book is now out, and you have...
Right.
Chronicled fundamental differences in the reality of the Manson killings and the investigation and the adjudication of SANE. And you have chronicled the involvement of elements of the intelligence community with the Manson milieu. Late in the book, you ruminate about how some of the links were not absolutely nailed down. Perhaps we'll talk about that. Some reviewers have taken advantage of that to say, well, you know, it's just conspiracy theory after all. I think there is a metaphor from radio astronomy and astrophysics in which the existence of a powerful gravitational field in deep space can be absolutely determined by the distortion of the light waves that pass by it, even though the original source of the gravity or the source of the gravity itself remains invisible. And I think from a methodological standpoint, your investigation of Manson and company could be evaluated in the same way. And I don't think that the reviewers who have dismissed this as conspiracy theory are really standing on solid ground. So before we even get into that, I want to mention to listeners that there is no way that we will be able to chronicle all or even most of the profound discontinuities and unimaginable twists and turns in the story. So please go out and buy the book and encourage others to do the same thing using social media, the internet, or what have you. Tom, a place that we might start. The Manson killings took place, or the killings by the family took place on August 8th and 9th of 1969. And another killing of a musician named Gary Hinman by a guy named Bobby Beausoleil, a member of the Manson family, yielded a tapped telephone call by Beausoleil, which should have tipped off the authorities long before they made the arrest. I wonder if you would develop Hinman, Beausoleil, that tapped phone call, and the curious nature of that and the investigation of the killings.
Yeah, well, that was one of the surprising moments in my reporting when a couple of cops or sheriffs who were investigating the Hinman murder by Bobby Beausoleil, who was in custody at the time of the Tate LaBianca murders, said, one in particular, Charlie Gontler, who was the lead investigator in the Hinman murder case, contacted me via a third party and told me, they said he had something very important to tell me. He wouldn't tell it to me on the telephone. I had to come see him at his house in Victorville, which was a good drive from Los Angeles, I think about an hour and a half or so. And I was curious, and I knew who Gunther was. He was a pretty well-known homicide cop. He'd actually figured in a couple of James Ellroy books. And James Ellroy had called him probably the best homicide cop he'd ever encountered in all his years of crime writing. Other people had said that as well. He was retired. So I drove out to see him in Victorville, and it took him a while to tell me what he was going to tell me. And he was obviously very emotional about it. He also wouldn't let me tape record our conversation, but we were in his living room. He kind of got up and down and paced a lot, and then finally told me that there had been a tape made of Bobby calling the ranch and telling the female answer on the other end of the phone, the payphone there, that he was arrested for the murder of Gary Hinman, and that Charlie should do something and to leave a sign to make it look like it was identical to the Hinman murder scene. That, and these are my words, not his, but that it would exonerate him. So what Charlie basically told me was there was audio tape of Bobby telling Manson to commit murders, copycat murders, the same night that Sharon Tate was killed, or afternoon. And Charlie said he wouldn't go on the record with me unless I could get Aaron Stovitz, who was the original prosecutor of the Tate LaBianca case, with Vince Bugliosi as his second. Unless I could get Aaron Stovitz to go on the record with him, and Aaron wouldn't go on the record. And all he said is, unless you can produce notes, I don't know what he's talking about. And it took quite some time, and if your listeners read the book, they'll see that I eventually got Charlie and his partner, Whiteley, to go on the record, even though Aaron Stovitz wouldn't. And there's a pretty compelling case that this tape did exist and was destroyed at the order of the superior of Charlie and his partner, Paul Whiteley, George Walsh, who was the head of homicide at the Sheriff's Department. And George Walsh wouldn't talk to me because he was really the only, Whiteley confirmed the existence of the tape. Stovitz actually danced about it a little bit. It didn't confirm it, but he did not deny it. But George Walsh was the most important person, and he wouldn't talk to me. So that suggested that the police knew who killed the Tate LaBianca murders within 48 hours, who committed them within 48 hours. Now, Vince Bugliosi talks about Gunther and Whiteley going to the Tate autopsy to tell the LAPD. There were two different jurisdictions. That Hinman was killed in the sheriff's jurisdiction, and Tate and LaBianca were in Los Angeles Police Department jurisdiction. And Gunther and Whiteley did go and tell one of the LAPD officers at the autopsy that they were pretty sure they knew who committed these murders because they had an identical crime scene. There was a bunch of hippies that lived on a place called the Spawn Ranch. They were led by a guy named Charlie, who they believe was a kind of combination of Jesus Christ and the devil. And the LAPD told them to get lost, that they already had a good lead on why and how the murders happened of Sharon Tate, and they weren't interested. The problem with that was Gunther and Whiteley were really good cops. And I said, okay, I understand them telling you to get lost, but number one, you were still looking for two accomplices. You knew there were two women who participated in the murder of him and with Bobby Beausoleil. Basically held him in his house as a prisoner for 3 days and tortured him. And a couple of his friends had called, and one had actually gone to the door and seen Susan Atkins. So I said, that doesn't make sense that you would just pull off, even if it wasn't your case, the Tate murders. You had enough information to go to the Spawn Ranch and interview everybody in search of evidence to support, you know, the Bobby Beausoleil as a suspect, and also in search of the accomplices, the female accomplices who were at large. And that's where I kind of went at loggerheads with them, because I think they realized then they shouldn't have told me what they told me, because it didn't explain why they also did pull off of the case. And you'll see my hypothesis for why that happened. I could never get them to admit it. I went back to see Charlie quite a bit until he died. I think about 10 times, about 10 different trips to Victorville, trying to get him to tell me, you know, basically would say, Charlie, come on, you were too good a cop. You could have gone onto the Spawn Ranch. You were looking for one stolen vehicle, because they had one in custody, but there was a second one. Also, they found out later that, they knew at the time what was missing from Hinman's house, and among the things that were missing was, bagpipes. Hinman was a bagpipe player. And they were at the Spahn Ranch. And had they gone there, they could have done a search of the ranch, gotten the bagpipes. They could have questioned people. So that their story kind of fell apart after that. But, yeah, that when I learned about that, the existence of that tape, or I should say the alleged existence because I never heard it or even saw it in anyone's notes, kind of changed the course of my reporting.
You were talking about the Spahn Ranch, and on August 16th of 1969, roughly a week after the Tate-LaBianca killings, there was a massive Los Angeles Sheriff's Office raid on the Spahn Ranch and the Manson family, and that in and of itself is very remarkable. Tell us about the raid, what they found, and what was the outcome of that investigation.
Well, it was the largest raid in the history of the state of California to that point in time. The only raid, I think, that superseded it later was when the police surrounded the house that they thought Patty Hearst was hiding in, and turned out there were about four or five other SLA members there. I think it was 74 or 75, and it was a massive shootout. But that SWAT operation was the only one that's ever been bigger than the Spahn Ranch raid. Not a lot of people know that because Bugliosi really minimizes it in Helter Skelter. I think he gives it 20, 30 words, you know, like a half a paragraph. He doesn't talk about the search warrants that were 16 pages long that identified Manson as the leader of this car theft ring, who was a federal parolee who had all these young kids under his spell, including runaway girls, underage girls, that there were narcotics there. There was an arsenal of weapons, including an automatic machine gun. And sure enough, when they did the raid, they got all that evidence, and Manson even had stolen credit cards in his shirt pocket when he was taken into custody. And despite all of that, not only didn't they press charges against Manson or anyone, they let them go after 72 hours. And Manson also could have just been violated on 10 different things alone. You know, he's not allowed to be in the company of underage girls as a pet parolee. Narcotics, weapons, machine guns, stolen property, stolen cars. So in the book Helter Skelter, Bugliosi wrote that the reason that the charges weren't filed and Manson wasn't violated was because the warrant was misstated. And that was another kind of turning point for me in my reporting, was I got a hold of the warrant and saw that it wasn't misstated, and I got a hold of the sergeant that wrote the warrant, Bill Gleason, who told me that it wasn't misstated. It had a different date than the date of the raid. It was dated August 13th. That's when the judge signed it. But they have 10 days after the 13th to execute it, and the raid was the 16th. So, I mean, when I began reporting this in 1999, talking about it now makes it sound like all this stuff kind of unfolded quickly, but a lot of this stuff took months to develop and to get people to trust me and to talk to me, and then to get the backing up, supporting documents and things. So that was another little brick in the house that was pulled out and caused it to crumble, you know, the official version of the murders.
Again, Manson was a federal parolee. This was roughly a week after the Tate-LaBianca killings.
Right.
He has weapons, underage girls, narcotics, stolen credit cards, and yet nothing was done.
I know you're familiar with Mae Brussel and her reporting, which came long, long before my reporting back in the early 70s. She was questioning, you know, the integrity of the information that they released about this raid and the fact that it didn't make any sense. And I had heard about her. You might have been one of the ones who told me, Dave, because you and I had these early conversations in the first year of my reporting. I started listening to Mae Brussel's tapes, audio tapes. I think you can probably listen to them online now, but you sure couldn't then. And a lot of this stuff that she put out there on the airwaves sounded crazy and conspiracy-like, but what I found out was, I wouldn't say 50% of what she was reporting was true, because she would always spin off into really wild areas, but the nut, you know, kind of the basis of just about everything she reported, especially concerning this case, turned out to be accurate. So she was a pioneer. She was ahead of her time.
Yeah, I played.
He was the first person, I think, to really question this raid long before I did.
Yeah, I played Mays tapes four times a week all over the Silicon Valley on two different stations. So the long-time listeners are familiar with that, although that was more than 30 years ago.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Pivoting from that, Ray, which is in and of itself unthinkable, just imagine, Tom, for the sake of argument, suppose Charlie Manson and all the people at the Spa Ranch, the girls, the young women, and the others, suppose they've been black. Can you imagine that would have been it? They would say, so long, and they would have locked them up and thrown away the key. That would have been
right.
It. And yet Manson was, maybe he was a combination of Jesus and the devil, because he was able to walk on water, at least this instant.
Or he had protection, because I do think if he was any other hippie on parole, and, he hated being called a hippie. He called himself a slippy, based on his, and his followers' practice of slipping in and out of places and homes to steal things, rearrange furniture, what they call creepy crawling. But I think if it was anyone else with his record, whether they were black or white, I think they wouldn't have gotten out after that, the massive amount of effort that went into that raid. I think it was 100 and some officers, all-terrain vehicles, helicopters. It was in the planning works for about 4 or 5 weeks. They gathered pre-dawn. They invaded the ranch from like 6 different launching points. I mean, if you see the plans, which I have, it's pretty incredible, how important this was to them. So I do think that, and, you'll see that, or your listeners will see that if they get the book, that I develop a pretty strong case of the fact that Manson was getting privileges that most other people don't get through parole and through law enforcement circles that, unfortunately, I could never really identify who he was working for, but people who really understood how the law worked, including a retired DA of the San Fernando Valley, Lewis Watnick, who looked at all the reports I had, said, look, sometimes this can be explained by incompetence, bureaucratic red tape. He said, not this. He said, they too consistently caught and released him. There's just no other explanation for this except for him being more valuable to someone outside than inside, meaning out on the streets rather than inside prison walls. He said someone wanted him out there. He was trading information, and he challenged me to find out who it was. And I asked him that day back in, I think, 2001 or two, who are you talking about? He goes, it could have been a federal agency. It could have been the FBI. It could have been state, local, Los Angeles Police Department, sheriff. Somebody with power wanted Manson free. So to hear that from somebody who worked in the DA's office for his entire career was pretty astonishing to me, but I heard it from more people after the fact, but he was the first one that really kind of validated my earliest reporting, from the other side, the side of people that otherwise would never say what he said. He was dying at the time. I mean, he was on a ventilator. He had a raspy voice. I audio recorded him, and luckily it's all on audio tape, but I think he had less to lose when he told me that.
And I would add that it was not just Charlie Manson, but a lot of the people around him. And it wasn't just with regard to the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office and the events we have already talked about. Let's pivot to what took place in the courtroom. Susan Atkins, if you would tell us about her no-deal deal and the remarkable replacement of Mr. Condon, her defense lawyer, by the DA's office, with Richard Caballero and Paul Caruso. That, in and of itself, is highly unusual and remarkable, and maintaining that metaphor, indicative of a powerful political gravitational field, invisible past a point, but distorting what passes by it. Go ahead.
I thought that was one of my most important finds. I first found documents in the sheriff's files once I got, actually Gunther and Whiteley were so pissed off that Aaron Stovitz, the deputy DA, who was at, you know, for the first year of the case, well, about 8 months of it, was the lead prosecutor with Vince and his second lead, Bugliosi. They wanted me to find the paperwork, and they thought it would be in the files that the sheriffs had, and they got me into those files through a back door. One of their other buddies, who was also retired, was in charge of security at the barracks at the training facility that the sheriffs used to train new sheriffs out in East L.A. So I was going to this barracks, and I don't want to say the guy's name because I'm pretty sure he got in trouble when Lee Baca, the sheriff, found out about 5 or 6 years later that I'd been in there for the whole summer. But this guy was letting me in every day to look at, you know, these two filing cabinets full of paperwork. And I was looking for the Stovitz information, never found it on paper. But I did find a lot of important documents, and one of them was about a meeting that had taken place in the district attorney's office. I think, I don't have my book at hand, but I think it was November 20th, maybe. It was right after Susan Atkins had been charged in the Hinman murder, and she was awaiting arraignment on that. And she'd been appointed, she got in a court-appointed attorney, Gerald Condon, and who was working with his brother Milton on her defense. And during the week prior to her arraignment was when the LAPD learned that she was telling fellow inmates at Sybil Brand, the woman's jail, about her and other people's involvement in the murder of Sharon Tate and the LaBiancas. So once they realized how important she could be to cracking this case that, you know, had occurred in, the murders occurred in August, and this was mid to late November when they finally got this break, although, again, I think they knew about it long before. But when they realized they had somebody who they could manipulate, they also understood that any defense attorney who's looking out for their client's best interest wouldn't do what they wanted them to do. So I have the minutes of this meeting where they said that they were going to have the Condons replaced with somebody who would exert more, what I think the words were, client control over Atkins. In other words, get her to do whatever they needed her to do in exchange for getting indictments against the rest of the family members. So again, none of these people had been publicly identified yet as suspects in this case. That didn't happen until December 1st. So during that week, a plan was hatched at this meeting, and they were going to go to Mario Klinko, who was a superior court judge in Santa Monica, who was presiding over Atkins' arraignment that was scheduled for November 26th. So I found that document, talked to the Condon brothers, who are both alive then, and both of them said, all we know is we were taken off the case at that November 26th arraignment. We protested it. Susan Atkins protested it. And the judge, Mario Klinko, never told us why. He just removed us, and he replaced us with Dick Caballero, who was a former prosecutor. And Jerry Condon, who was, you know, the main attorney for Susan, told me, I never, ever would have walked away from that. I would have fought the judge and said, you know, this doesn't make any sense. You've got to give me a reason. Why am I being removed? You've already appointed me to this. But he said, by then, I had been told that she was a suspect in the Tate LaBianca murders, and I had told my wife about it. And he said it was my wife who said, I don't want you to fight for this because I'm terrified by what all this might mean to us and our safety. So he said because of his wife, he didn't fight it. Otherwise, he would have. Then about a year later, when I found the son of one of the head of the LaBianca cop investigation team, there were two teams, a Tate team and a LaBianca team, and contacted him. He was dead, the head, but the son said I could come out to see him at his office, I think in Laguna Beach. And he said, I got a whole box of my father's reports that he never got rid of on this investigation. And in those reports, I found a second document, not only showing that they had accomplished what they set out to do. This report was about Dave Fitz, who was the DA in charge of Santa Monica. And he said, I went to Klinko and Klinko agreed to do this. So we have nothing to worry about on the November 26th. The Condons will be removed and Dick Caballero will be appointed. And he was. And again, you know, there was no news reporting of any of this stuff because Susan Atkins wasn't identified yet as a suspect in Tate Babianca. Law enforcement knew it, but the press didn't, and the public didn't. And once that happened, once the lawyers were switched, and essentially a prosecution attorney was planted, you know, on the most important witness at that point, because she was the one that they needed to talk, and she wouldn't talk.
As her defense attorney.
Yeah, until she got this new defense attorney who was planted by the prosecution. Everything that we know about the case from that day forward, the minute that Caballero took over her defense, should not be trusted. It will be thrown out now. I mean, it's one of the things that disappoints me about this. I mean, I didn't think that this information was going to cause any kind of legal procedure, but I did think that the local press, particularly the LA Times, follow up on my reporting and find out, number one, you know, go to the people who are alive today who can, you know, deny that what I found is important. Right? But, you know, the LA Times hasn't done a single story. They reviewed my book, and I actually got a pretty good review from them. But Richard Winton, their head crime reporter, has written about, you know, the anniversary, and he's just repeating and parroting everything Bugliosi reported in his book. The Los Angeles Times isn't interested in it. And unfortunately, I think all the people that got convicted were involved in the murders and belonged behind bars, but also there were other people that were involved in this, that the prosecution and the DA's office, and who knows who they were answering to, but you get an idea of that when you read the book, you know, protected and kept out. You know, Manson was not the designer of all this. Somebody was pulling Manson's strings, and maybe that's why the LA Times won't have Richard Winton report on it, but that's been the biggest disappointment of all of this. When you talk about the reviews, you know, where the critics are saying, you know, he raises all these interesting points, but in the end, he doesn't ever prove anything, and he admits he didn't find anything. That doesn't bug me at all, because the more serious journalists get it, and they actually, you know, some of my best reviews have come from, like, The Guardian and, ironically, the LA Times and The Washington Post, and they've said that even if I don't provide final answers, definitive answers, I raise so many questions about the official narrative that you really can't trust it anymore, and that this stuff needs to be followed up on. But nobody in the mainstream media is doing it, to my knowledge, and that's pretty discouraging. Maybe not. Maybe I shouldn't have been that naive to think it might happen. But I think the Atkins information in my book is one of the most explosive findings of the entire 500-some-page book.
Absolutely. And again, I suggest in passing the metaphor of radio astronomy and astrophysics, where a powerful gravitational field is at work, politically speaking, and it is perverting what passes by it. Vis-a-vis Susan Atkins, and very quickly, there was a book that was published by a guy named Lawrence Schiller, whom we spoke about. I did a 25-hour series of interviews with Jim DiGiamio about his book, Destiny Betrayed, about the Jim Garrison investigation. And Lawrence Schiller, his links with the FBI, and his writing of a manicured account of Jack Ruby figured in there. And once again, Lawrence Schiller enters into the Atkins situation. Fill us in on that, if you would, Tom.
You know, Jim, I talked to quite a bit, and he was very supportive of me and my reporting and my book. He gave me a pretty bad review in his own website, which I think he wrote it about a month or so ago, and somebody just sent it to me a few days ago. I mean, it wasn't bad. It was balanced, but there was a couple things that he criticized me about and the book about. And I'm on the road right now and traveling and doing tons of publicity. But when I get back to L.A., I don't know if he listens to your show, but I'm going to call him up and say, Jim, we need to have lunch again, because I don't think it was fair, some of your criticisms of the book. But anyway, he reported about Schiller. So did Joan Mellon, I think, wrote a book about the Garrison investigation. And she writes about Jerry Cohen and Lawrence Schiller and how they kind of infiltrated Garrison's investigation and were, I think she saw the same documents that I found at the National Archives, but she doesn't quote any of them in her book, and I don't think Jim did either, but I actually have them in my book. You know, Schiller was a narc. I mean, he was working for the FBI to disrupt Jim Garrison's investigation of the Kennedy assassination. And he did this in other cases, too, but particularly he did it in Manson. Once Caballero got the Susan Atkin case, he took Larry Schiller on and got Schiller to write this front-page story for the L.A. Times that went global and about Atkin's version of how and why the murders happened, which was a script that the DA's office had written. And Schiller was a shill, you know, in that. Like, he'd always been. Here's one of the bigger surprises of the aftermath of the book. You know, oh, sorry about this. Hang on one second.
Well, you know, it's oddly appropriate, actually.
Really?
There is a bit of existential soundtrack there. There's perhaps
where the black helicopters now.
Very, very, very apropos.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Lawrence Schiller, the FBI, and again his very curious publication of Susan Atkin's story. Go ahead.
My collaborator and I and my publisher, you know, I have an insurance policy with the publisher for any kind of libel or defamation suit.
Mm-hmm.
And Little Brown expected them. And, you know, we didn't discuss it too much, but they said, you know, we can cover you for a certain amount of money if you get sued. And Dan, my collaborator, and I drew up a little list of the five most likely people to sue us when the book came out. And Schiller was at the top of the list. And I'm shocked that the book's been out for 2 months now. It came out June 25th, I think, so we're past August 25th. Haven't heard a peep from him or the other four people who we were certain were going to file libel suits against us, defamation, you know, whatever. Because, you know, well, Schiller's better known than the other four, but Schiller also, you know, knows how to pull the media strings and knows how to play the media. And I thought there was no way he was going to back down from this. And he hasn't done a thing. I mean, I talk to my publishers every few days or correspond with them through emails. And I thought they would serve papers at Little Brown first, my publisher, or at my agent, or me, lastly, but nothing. So I don't know what that means. You know, I've got 60 pages of endnotes at the back of the book,
right,
where you see all of my source material and all of the document locations, what they're called, where to find them, et cetera. And maybe that's it. Maybe they saw that all my reporting is ironclad. I'm staying in Philadelphia now on a visit, and Schiller had lived in Los Angeles in Ventura County for years, but he's now living in Bucks County, which is about 45 minutes from where I'm staying. And I'm considering, depending on how long I stay, it's still kind of up in the air, to take a drive out there and knock on his door. Because, you know, you see in the book, I tried talking to him long before I published any of this, you know, years before. I would write letters to him. He wouldn't answer any of them. But his assistants and the people that worked with him said he had no interest in talking to me about not only the Manson case, but any of the cases he was involved in for his career. So I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop, but nothing's happened.
Pivoting now again to unusual goings on in the courtroom, and this will serve as something of a pivot point to one of the things that appears to involve the intelligence community, bearing in mind some of the things we have already spoken about and your own differences with Jim DiGiamio notwithstanding. I believe his documentation in Destiny Betrayed about Lawrence Schiller's work with the FBI is pretty firm. But on page 291 and 292, you write the following, Tom. Manson's complete profile has never been released. It wasn't even permitted into evidence during the trial. During the death penalty phase, the defense's Irving Kamarek had subpoenaed the file, hoping he could use some part of it to argue for his client's life. Not only did United States Attorney General John Mitchell refuse to release it, he dispatched David Anderson, an official from the Justice Department, to aid Bugliosi in his effort to quash the subpoena. It was almost an unprecedented action. During the death penalty arguments, when the defendant's life hangs in the balance, anything that could be introduced to save that life is routinely allowed into evidence. In the courtroom, stunned that the government wouldn't allow Manson access to his own file, defense attorney Kamarek asked Anderson if it contained information that would, quote, incriminate the attorney general.
Bugliosi, John Mitchell.
Exact, of the United States. Bugliosi objected, the judge sustained, and Anderson didn't have to answer. Ultimately, the judge upheld the prosecution's motion to quash the subpoena. The file was never allowed into evidence, and the whole episode was excluded from Helter Skelter. Here you have the highest law enforcement official in the U.S.
Thank you. Right, right.
Acting in an unthinkable fashion to quash the release of Manson's parole file to his defense attorney during the death penalty phase of the trial. This is stunning. And again, the metaphor. Well, go ahead, develop that for us, if you would.
Well, we also, you know, we had to pare away so much information. I can't remember now. Sometimes I can't remember what we left in and what we left out. It might be in the end notes, but it took me forever to find David Anderson because it's such a generic name.
Yep.
But when I finally found him, he insisted I had the wrong David Anderson, even though he was in the Attorney General's office. He was a United States attorney for the feds in Los Angeles. He finally admitted when I sent him the transcript, which included his middle initial and his office location, you know, of him appearing before the judge to deny the release, saying he had been sent there. He finally said, well, you know what? That had to be me, but I have to tell you, I have no recollection of that. And I said to him, I go, with all due respect, Mr. Anderson, I understand people having, you know, we all have fallible memories, we can forget stuff, but you were standing in front of the judge with Charles Manson at the defendant's table behind you with the two girls, and at that stage they had shaved heads and you know, carved crosses on their foreheads, and the entire thing was the biggest circus in the history of jurisprudence, and you have no recollection of being at that trial and appearing before the judge for what had to have been a good half hour, 45-minute session that day. And he goes, I don't have no recollection. And this was 30 years after it happened. So this is about, well, maybe 2000, so about 31 years after. And you have to give people the benefit of the doubt, but I told him, I said, I honestly just don't believe that. I mean, I would believe that if you said, I remember being there, but I don't remember what happened. But for you to say you don't have any recollection of being involved in the Charles Manson murder trial, I have people I've talked to who had much less of a connection to it, who might have, like, sat in, you know, in the public rows one day and just watched the trial, and they never forget it, you know. So, yeah, there was a lot of that. And that was one of the most frustrating things in the world, when I would finally find these people and try to get, you know, break them and get the information. Instead, you would get, well, I don't remember. It was like Bob Schoen, the DA who released the Manson family after the August 16th Spahn Ranch raid. When I asked him, you know, why he released them, he said, oh, because it was a misstated warrant. And then I brought him the warrant and I brought him the information. I said, it wasn't misstated. I go, you had every right to at least hold Manson, because Manson actually had stolen credit cards that were linked to a break-in of an automobile of a doctor in the valley. I mean, I found the doctor. He told me about finding his car broken into and his credit card stolen. And then I said to him, I go, so why, if the warrant was valid, why didn't you, you know, press charges? Because he was the one who made the final decision. And he looked at me like a deer in headlights, and he said, I honestly can't tell you that. And I said, you can't tell me because you won't? You're choosing not to tell me, or because you can't remember? He goes, I can't tell you that. That's my answer. So I would walk away from that. You know, what do I do with that? Does can't tell you mean I don't remember, or I'm not allowed to tell you? And that happened again and again and again in my reporting over 20 years. Every time I get to a point that I thought was going to be a big breakthrough, because I had somebody on the spot, you know, with all the documents where I thought they were going to have to tell me the truth, I would get those inexplicable scenes where they would say something like, you know, I can't tell you, I won't tell you, or I don't remember being in the Manson trial.
Considering that he was acting on behalf, according to what you wrote, on behalf of the Attorney General of the United States to prevent a defendant's parole file from being released to his defense attorney. That is extraordinary.
And, of course, you know, John Mitchell went to prison a couple years later. That was who he was representing, you know, John Mitchell's order not to release it.
It's interesting that Irving Kamarek asked David Anderson, does it have information that would incriminate John Mitchell? Well, that may have been a rhetorical flourish. Who knows? It may have. We've got about a little under 20 minutes left here, Tom, in the interview.
Okay.
Pivoting from the parole file per se to something that will lead into the intelligence community involvement with the Manson case, Roger Smith was Manson's federal parole officer, and despite numerous brushes with the law, violations of law by Manson, and violations by Susan Atkins, not just in California, Northern California, Southern California, up in Oregon. Roger Smith not only didn't do anything to revoke Manson's parole, he actually became the guardian for Manson's kid. bearing in mind the limitation of time, if you could encapsulate Roger Smith and his remarkable activities for us.
Yeah, I know we only have 20 minutes. I'll try to keep it to two. It's pretty hard to try to get, you know, all the background. But Roger Smith was assigned Manson as a parole client after Manson violated parole the day he was released from Los Angeles. And again, Bugliosi wrote in Helter Skelter, he was released on March 21st, 1967. He requested permission to go live in, you know, his parole was assigned to Los Angeles, but he requested permission to go to the Bay Area. And he was given that permission. Well, when I got access to Manson's parole file, I found out that he had never received permission. He went up there in violation of his parole. He should have been sent back to prison the first week he was out. Instead, they gave him Roger Smith as a parole officer who was getting his master's or PhD at Berkeley School of Criminology. And his focus was violence, group violence, and drugs. And within about 18 months of him getting assigned Manson, Manson was his only parole client, and he was meeting him once a week. And after the first 6 months or so, when he started doing a drug research project at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic that had opened in June of 1967, he redirected Manson from the federal parole office, where Manson had to go in for weekly meetings with him to the, he said, I'm going to be at the clinic, just meet me there. So, Roger Smith is alive. He's another person that we were certain was going to sue us. Haven't heard a word from him. He's another enigma. He had all this information about Manson, and instead of violating him, he would just encourage him to do what he wanted to do. He knew what Manson was doing with the girls, that he was forming this group, that he knew what they were doing. And when Susan Atkins and Mary Bruner got arrested in Mendocino on contributing to the delinquency of minors charges in 1960, I guess it was the spring or summer of 1968, Roger and his wife went out up there from San Francisco and petitioned the court to become the foster parents, temporary foster parents of Pooh Bear, who was Manson's firstborn family child, born to Mary Bruner. So they had custody of that kid for a couple months. And when the probation investigator was doing his report after they'd been convicted and the judge had to decide whether to send them to prison or give them probation, his name was David Mandel, the investigator. He interviewed Roger Smith, and Roger Smith said, both of these women, Susan Atkins and Mary Bruner, are good people. They're just living an alternative lifestyle, but they're, you know, Mary's a great mom. Susan's a wonderful person. And they should not, you know, be sent to prison. They should be given probation.
Yeah, we've got now about 15 minutes, Tom. Again, there is far too much in your book for us to cover in the amount of time that we have left, or in the entire hour. So I want to again encourage members of the audience to go out and buy it and see the many profound and I think to many unthinkable distortions of criminal investigative procedure by the law enforcement authorities, the practice of jurisprudence in the case, and the behavior of the corrections department and people like Roger Smith and others, and the powerful gravitational field that appears to have been distorting all of this.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
In the book, you speak about the fact, you talk about the COINTELPRO program, Operation Chaos by the CIA, and activities against the anti-war movement, against so-called black militants like the Black Panthers, and mentioned that people like Evel Younger, the DA for Los Angeles, had strong links to the intelligence community, as did members of LAPD like William Herman. In San Francisco, both the aforementioned Roger Smith, the federal parole officer for Manson, and Dr. David Smith, who headed up the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, were involved with research into LSD, into amphetamines, and at the same time the National Institute of Mental Health was involved with that, which has served as a CIA conduit in the past. And into this whole mix, although never nailed down past a point, comes a name well known to the veteran listeners, Louis Jolyon West. How does he figure into this?
Jolyon West was a psychiatric researcher and professor at University of Oklahoma in 1966, who went on leave of absence for the academic year of 67, and again, to condense it, ended up at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, where David Smith gave him an office to recruit subjects for an LSD study he was doing, the hippies and LSD, right at the kind of explosion of the Summer of Love and the Hate. And what nobody knew at the time, I don't know if David Smith knew it or not, I wouldn't be surprised if he did, he told me he didn't, was that West was secretly employed by the CIA for those years to do MKUltra research, which I think your listeners probably already know about what MKUltra was. Sure. And here's an interesting footnote that I don't know if you know about, and I only found out about it recently, but about 3 weeks after my book came out, the clinic, the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, announced that after 52 years it was shutting its doors.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
golly.
It closed.
And although, again, you never could establish a hard link between Manson per se or his family per se and L. Jolyon West, an executive-level spook, a mind control researcher and practitioner par excellence, Manson and family were deeply involved with the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, and so was Louis Jolyon West. And again, the background of COINTELPRO, Operation Chaos, people like Evel Younger, people like William Herman in the LAPD are all elements that factor into the overall analysis. And again, the metaphor that I have offered up, that there is a powerful, all-distorting gravitational field that is altering fundamentally everything that passes by. Just as in astrophysics, it alters the light that passes
by. Dave, I'm getting your metaphor a little bit more now that we've talked for an hour. It's making more sense to me. So.
Yeah, I mean, nothing in this case goes the way it would have gone unless it was being distorted by something very powerful. And I'd like to, in the 10 minutes or so that we have left, to discuss some of the many connections of a fascinating person that you bring in, a fellow named Reeve, R-E-E-V-E, Whitson. How does he connect? First of all, we've got about a little less than 10 minutes. We're going to have to hit these points quickly. First, how does Reeve Whitson link to the Manson case?
In a nutshell, Reeve Whitson was working for the CIA in the 50s and 60s. in counterintelligence, and the people who I spoke to who knew who he was and what he did said he was in a rogue element of the CIA that didn't even have a name. What I found out through my reporting was that Woodson had, I mean, he definitely was, I can document him on the periphery or central to the LAPD's investigation. Robert Helder, who headed the Tate murder investigation for the LAPD, wrote a book a few years after it was over with Paul Tate, who was Sharon Tate's father, was also from military intelligence. And he identifies Reed, he gives him a pseudonym, but Paul Tate, Sharon's father, confirmed that it was him, as someone who led them to all of the suspects and all the key points that they needed in the investigation before they knew why they were going there. Reed would direct them. What I found from Reeves' attorney and two of his closest friends and a family member was that he told them right before he died in the mid-90s that his biggest regret was that he could have prevented the murder of Sharon Tate but didn't. And when they tried to get information from him by what that meant, all he would say was, I was involved in an operation where I infiltrated the group posing as a hippie, and the night of the murders, I was at the scene of the killings after they'd already been committed, but before the police arrived. And that all actually fits into the timeline. There was, after the murders had been completed, which was around 1 o'clock in the morning, there were these unaccountable or never explained noises that were reported by about four or five witnesses in the vicinity of Cielo Drive, of gunshots, screaming, and fighting that all occurred at 4 in the morning. So there was this window from about 1 in the morning till the bodies were discovered at 8 that Reed basically said that he was there. And if your listeners read the book, you'll see why. And again, this is something I couldn't definitively prove, but I present a hypothesis that supports what Manson has said before he passed away, a little bit about going back to the scene and rearranging it with someone who he never identified to suit the purposes of implicating the Panthers, which actually didn't happen, but it was a last-ditch effort.
There is a suggestion that Reed Woodson actually was surveilling the property on the night of the killings. Reed Woodson himself, as an individual, you spoke about the fact that he was working for an element of CIA, and a fellow named Irvin, I believe John Irvin himself, apparently was linked to British, mentioned that he could get a meeting with a top defense contractor on minutes' notice. That's remarkable. Tell us about that.
Yeah. John Irving is a British film director who told me he was part of British intelligence, and that's how he met Reed before he became a film director. He'd become quite close to him, and he said Reed was everything that I believed him to be. I mean, the problem was I couldn't get the CIA to give me anything but what they call a Glomer response, which is we can neither confirm nor deny that this person had anything to do with us. But Irving said, you know, there was a lot of anecdotal information, not just from John Irving, but from other people who were very close to Reeve about him associating with people like Curtis LeMay. And that leads us to Otto Scorzani and Elsa Scorzani, Charlie Barron, all these kind of dark military operatives. Or, I mean, Curtis LeMay wasn't a military operator. He was a well-known chief of the Air Force who was bombs away at LeMay. All that stuff is hard to explain in a few minutes, but if your listeners buy the book, they'll get all the context in the background.
Yeah, Curtis LeMay was Air Force Chief of Staff and implicated by some in the JFK assassination, and he was close to Woodson. You mentioned that he went to work for a defense firm that was headed up by a former member of the Iron Guard.
Mihai Petrici.
That's it, Mihai Petrici. Yeah. And also, again, in the friends of Reed Woodson, Otto Scorzani, a name well known to our listeners. Briefly, hit on that for us, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on what you read and what you believe, but Scorzani should have been prosecutor for war crimes and wasn't. He was held in jail, and he escaped from prison and fled Germany and ended up in, I think, Austria or Switzerland with his wife, and during the 1950s and 60s was coming over to the United States and getting involved in all kinds of weird CIA domestic operations, and that is supposedly how Reed met him. And I was able to confirm that, you know, Reeve had this relationship with him. And Scorsese was kind of a mastermind of the dark arts for the Nazis and then later for the United States government.
Yeah, he was involved on the one hand with the whole Nazi diaspora and post-war underground, and also with the Galen spy outfit working for CIA, NATO, and Germany. In terms of understanding the power that was involved in this gravitational field we have been speaking about, you write, and I'm quoting here. Reeve Whitson,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Reeve Whitson was the special advisor to the chairman of the board of Thyssen. Among the largest corporations in Germany. That now is ThyssenKrupp and is the largest heavy industrial concern in Western Europe with 30% capital participation by the Rockefellers.
Right, right.
And he was special advisor to the chairman of the board.
Yeah, yeah, the tentacles go deep and wide, don't they?
Well, that's, as that old, Alka-Seltzer commercial said, that's a sum of specie meatball, you know. I mean, what you have here, again, this metaphor, which I hope I haven't belabored too much, but when you have a guy who was apparently surveilling the Cielo Drive home on the night of the killings, when you have a guy who was certainly involved with the Manson situation, although some areas remain indeterminate, and he's hooked up with people like Curtis LeMay, Otto Skorzeny, and now a special advisor to the chairman of the board of Thyssen. Thyssen was originally called the Rheinische Stahlwerke. It was capitalized from the highest echelons of Wall Street, and Fritz Thyssen was one of the early financial backers of the Nazi Party, was a business partner with George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, very close to Alan Dulles. And again, it is now they merge with Krupp, the traditional armorers of Germany, and it is the largest heavy industrial concern in all of Europe. So we're seeing Reeve Whitson networking with the chairman of the board of Thyssen. This is not only top echelon corporate power, it is transatlantic corporate power or cartel power, if you will. And that, I think, as one looks at your remarkable chronicle, and yet again I want to stress to listeners that we have only been able to scratch the surface of the unthinkable distortions in procedure at every level of the Manson case. There is a powerful political gravitational field distorting everything that goes past it. And although, again, some areas may be indeterminate, you've done a terrific job.
Thank you.
At great expense to yourself and great risk, frankly, in exposing what lies at the political gravitational epicenter in deep political space.
Yes, and please tell your listeners that I've got an Instagram page and a Facebook page where I've scanned as many of the documents as I can so far. I'm going to keep doing it. So stuff that we discuss, when, you know, even if you don't get the book, if people just want to see the documentation I have, they should go to my Instagram and Facebook page. They don't need to go to both. They basically both are for whatever audience follows Facebook or Instagram. But, you know, if you just do a Google search on my name, Manson, Chaos, and Instagram, and or Facebook, it'll take you right there. I also have audio tapes, snippets of audio interviews with Vince Pugliosi, Terry Melcher, Stephen Kay, Charles Manson, you know, little clips I put up. It's just a lot of the proof that I want people to see. There's, you know, a lot of evidence there that it's all in the end notes, but you can actually see everything on those sites.
And again, I want to stress, I, of course, make no money from this, and we have barely scratched the surface. So please get the book and examine the Instagram account and the Facebook page and take a look at what you have so laboriously and over a couple of decades' time cobbled together for us.
And don't be modest, Dave. You helped me with this in the very first year. I talked to you quite a bit. I think you sent me a lot of audio tapes. But we're only reconnecting now all these years later. But I really appreciate your help back then and your support now.
Well, you deserve it, is all I have to say. This concludes
Thank you.
For the Record program number 1085, interview with Tom O'Neill about chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the secret history of the 60s. This is being recorded on August 27th of the year 2019. For Tom O'Neill, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.